Hello and welcome to the Georgia Baptist Foundation podcast. I'm Jonathan Gray, President and CEO of the Georgia Baptist Foundation, and I have the privilege today of having Steve Foster, the evangelism catalyst for the Georgia Baptist Mission Board, as our guest. And we're just going to take some time today and talk a little bit about evangelism and personal evangelism and what it means for you to share your faith and maybe some ways that can help you think about that and ways that you can be more involved in sharing your faith. Steve, it's great to have you here today.
Good to be here.
I'd love to be able to just to kind of share with our audience just a little bit about you. Okay. So I know, you know, from our relationship, you've served as a full-time evangelist. Mm-hmm. You've been a pastor. Mm-hmm. You're now working for the Mission Board. If I remember correctly, you did some associational missionary work as well. So
yes.
Certainly when I think of guys that really understand evangelism and have tried to utilize a heart for evangelism mm-hmm. in different ministry roles, mm-hmm. you certainly have done that. Tell the audience this morning just a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? How'd you come to feel led to be an evangelist and the Lord kind of working in your life in that way?
Grew up in a very small town, Linden, Texas, and grew up in church, joined the church when I was 14, had some doubts about my salvation, and I had just turned 19, and the church I went to, a very small church, we always had a bivocational pastor, had a revival meeting, and during that week I realized that although I had a head knowledge of the gospel and Christ, I had never really committed my life to Christ. Mm. So I committed my life to Christ, and within about 2 months, I just felt a pulling and a call really into evangelism, and just so happened at the time I was called to preach that we had an interim, and he was a vice president at East Texas Baptist University, which is about 40 miles down the road, so mm-hmm. it was just a natural direction for me to go to East Texas Baptist. And while I was there, I met my wife, Deidre. We've been married this year, was 37 years.
Oh, wow. That's
and
great.
She's from South Texas and Corpus Christi. But the call to evangelism, there was an evangelist. In fact, he was preaching the revival that I surrendered, was saved in. And I got where I would go to some of his local church revival meetings. And I think that was a impact on my life. And secondly, at that time in Texas, there was an evangelist named James Robertson who still on mm-hmm. television. In fact, he turned 80 that last week, I think. But he, at that time, was doing these huge harvest events, and I would go to those. And I just think God began to stir in my heart the reality that the opportunity to gather people together at events and present the gospel was such an impactful opportunity to really influence a lot of people.
So, wow. Yeah. Now, how did you get from Texas to Georgia then?
So when I graduated college, I spent 3 years in what we call youth evangelism. Back mm-hmm. in those days, every church had youth revivals and stuff. And I was young back then. And I had a good friend from college that was from Louisiana. He had went to New Orleans. And long story short, being from Texas, I'm like, I'm going to Southwestern. Well, come check New Orleans out. And I did, and I just enjoyed the smallness of the school. It was a lot like East Texas Baptist, which turned out to be a blessing because I ended up on staff of First Baptist New Orleans as their evangelism pastor. And so for 3 years, I got to visit in homes every week. Interesting, back in those days, the culture was a little bit different than today. My role, I was supposed to make 100 gospel presentations a week, which you worked every day to do that. And
sure.
So it was great. It was great, in hindsight, a great opportunity for me because New Orleans was unlike any place I'd ever been. And so as you made visits, you visited all different type of cultures, all different type of folks, which laid a great foundation for evangelism. So.
Well, if you're sharing the gospel that much, you kind of get the hang of it.
That
don't
was
you?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
and share with everybody you come in contact
absolutely,
with.
Absolutely,
That's good. Well, I'm just curious, you know, with you being an evangelist and now doing what you're doing. Of course, all of us have seen where churches are not doing revivals.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of that role of the evangelist and leading revivals is unfortunately, in my opinion, you know, not as strong as it used to be. Well, one of the things that we're trying to communicate on this podcast is we know that the focus of the annual meeting this year is calling out the called.
Yes.
I would just be curious, from your perspective, kind of having lived in that world, watched really the world transition over the last 20 or 30 years, I would just be curious, what words would you say if there's a gentleman out there that says, you know, I really feel like God's calling me maybe to the role of evangelist or the gift of evangelism, you know, with that use of evangelism in my ministry, and maybe to be an evangelist. Are there any opportunities? I know they're fewer and further between, but what are you seeing for those type of guys that maybe in this generation have a heart to be an evangelist with that gift of evangelism?
And I would say you would have to distinguish between the theology of evangelism and the methodology. The role that we look at for the evangelists is greatly influenced probably from like the 1930s up to maybe the middle 1980s or so. Because even when I surrendered to preach, and this is hindsight, I didn't know at the time, revival meetings were declining somewhat, but there's still enough of them that people stayed busy. So when we think about an evangelist, we think usually of a Billy Graham style of evangelism, and which is was an awesome way to do it, and still a great way to do it. There's still guys who get to do that, but there's less and less opportunities. And what I would say is the theology of the evangelist is the evangelist is different than the pastor in the sense that he focuses solely on the gospel. That's basically what he does, where a pastor is more of a general practitioner, where he's, of course, preaching the gospel. He's preaching other doctrines to mature Christians. And so if a young man or even an older man felt led to do evangelism, I would say to him, don't limit yourself to thinking you have to do revival meetings. That is not
that's a good word.
That is not a methodology that's easy to do today and easy to make a living. I would say to him, be open to opportunities. I'll give you an example. I have a friend who was a vocational evangelist for probably 25 years. He's a association mission strategist now. So he has the opportunity in his role to impact about 60-something churches, and he weaves evangelism through everything he does, which is a needed ministry because a lot of churches are weak on evangelism. They don't necessarily focus on it. Secondly, because of his role, unlike being a pastor, they allow him to do a number of harvest events and revivals and so. And so he's got the best of both worlds. That's just one example. I think if someone's called, understand the theology of it, but don't get locked into the methodology of saying, I have to do it on a smaller scale the way Billy Graham did it. Because even Dr. Graham's ministry that he left, it doesn't do it quite like it did in his heyday just because of the culture changing and really the business of life. And one thing about the revival meetings, some of the decline in that has to do with the fact that when they were really used all the time, and churches did, a lot of them did two a year, a lot of times the wife did not work outside the house, and men who worked did not work far from where they lived. It was easier to attend a revival meeting in the church. And today our culture is so busy with all that we do. And I'm not putting that down. I'm just simply saying that understand if God's called you, there's ways to be a trainer. There's ways to engage in evangelism. And I would also say this, one of the main roles of an evangelist besides the preaching is actually being a trainer, is actually helping other people to share their faith. So
yeah, that's great. I think that'd be encouraging for those that are listening. They're just, you know, you kind of struggle with where the Lord's leading you and is he leading me into this? And and I'm sure for some of the younger guys out there, if he says, well, I feel like I've got this gift or this call to be an evangelist, but there's not really any opportunities out there. I think that's a great way to look at it. Yes. I would be curious just from, you know, your experience as an evangelist, with some of the stuff that we're seeing from a spiritual awakening standpoint today, you know, whether it be, you know, not too long ago at Asbury and then what seemed like what was a great response that Rick Gage had down in South Georgia, and some of the folks may have seen on social media some of the stuff that had taken place at Auburn. Just, I'd be curious to know kind of your thoughts. So what do you see? How do people interpret that? What do you sense as far as having been involved in that world for many years now?
Yeah, I do think there's a hunger for God. I think there's a hunger for even folks who may not think they're seeking God. They're seeking something, and God is the answer to what they're seeking. The great revivals throughout American history has always been like, for example, the Jesus movement in the 70s. When you look at the Jesus movement, what happened before then, there's a lot of unrest. There's a lot of, I mean, there's magazines like Time Magazine saying, is God dead? People were questioning church. Is church relevant? In the midst of that, the awakening began. I think that's happening in different places. And the Rick Gage, his crusades. He's doing one, I think, in Jackson, Mississippi this week. The Rick Gage crusades, they always work. And the reason for that is he has such a great team. There's a large team involved. And so when he goes in, for recently in South Georgia, when he went to that town, it's not only him going in, it's a team going in. And so with the churches involved and some of his associate evangelists that go into the schools and speaks, the crowd gathers. If you can get unchurched people to gather and you present the gospel, you're always going to see some people saved just because the gospel still works. And the difference in what he does and what I'd say that the normal evangelist does is there was a time 30, 40, 50 years ago, especially 50 years ago, where when you had a, quote, local church revival meeting, the culture was such that even unchurched people, not all but many of them, they would have a conversation as a couple to say, hey, next week the church having revival, what night do you want to go? It was just a cultural expectation that, say, since they're having a revival, we ought to go. Well, for an evangelist to stand up and preach every night and knowing there's a number of unchurched, lost people there, you always see a harvest. In today's society, often revival meeting, as we call them, you have more Christians who show up. That's the impact of the Gage Crusades, and he's great. I recommend him all the time. That's a great way to have an area-wide crusade, especially in a smaller town. He does a lot of smaller towns, and they always make an impact. So,
you know, it's interesting you say that, Steve, because the reality, it's almost obvious, but the reality is that if the church doesn't do something to attract lost folks to any ministry that they're doing, the likelihood that they're going to see folks come to know Christ is lessened because there's just not any lost people there. And so they've got to be strategic about that. And that may be some of what you're going to share here in just a minute or two. Kind of along those same lines, just would be curious, you know, from your perspective, it seems to me as though, you know, maybe there is a movement of God that's a little bit stronger now because of what's going on in our culture and society. Just your thoughts. Is it an opportunity that maybe pastors should be thinking, okay, what can I do to kind of catch maybe this movement of God within my congregation? And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, or be curious just where your perspective is there.
I think it is an opportunity. So like the Asbury Awakening, you want to call it, that recently happened, I think where we may be missing it, and I had a lot of conversations when it was going on because obviously it was everywhere.
Sure.
And a lot of people jumped on the fact that, hey, look at what's happening, because we're excited about, hey, maybe this is something that may sweep the nation. But I told a lot of guys in Georgia, I said, if you have a heart for this, understand that Asbury, they just didn't show up in chapel one day and this happened. They pray for that. It is part of their DNA. It's part of their history, because there's a number of, especially since the 50s, numerous times that something like this has happened. And but students have been praying and faculty have been praying for some time. So it's not like they just showed up and it's like, hey, wow, this just happened. Right. It looks like it just happened. It's kind of like the 10-day prayer meeting in the book of Acts, and all of a sudden Pentecost comes. It's like, well, they actually prayed for 10 days straight before that happened. So I've told pastors what was going on, and even now as they talk about it, if you're interested in something like this happening, gather two or three people. Two or three people might not sound like much, but two or three people praying for revival is better than nobody praying for spiritual awakening.
That's right.
So if I was a pastor and had a heart for this, I would just try to get me 3, 4, 5 people who would meet, and it doesn't matter when they met, but just meet weekly, just to say, you know, 7 o'clock Tuesday night, that we're going to meet for no other reason than to pray for spiritual awakening. And then have the commitment, like Asbury does, to say, we're not giving up. In other words, if I'm a freshman at Asbury and I'm part of that prayer time, it may not happen until 10 years after I graduate. Mm-hmm. So other people just have to take my place, and I'll pray for it wherever I am. If you have that commitment, sooner or later, something's probably going to happen. But the issue for us is, and it's an issue for me too, is having the commitment in our society to not want it instantly and to just keep pursuing God and just say, I want this so bad, I'm not giving up on it. It's similar to what I think the Brooklyn Tabernacle, their Tuesday night prayer meeting. Guys talk about that prayer meeting all the time, like, wow, And it's like, well, it wouldn't cost you anything in your church to have a prayer meeting weekly. But the difference is they've done it so long. It started with just a few people, and that's so huge. The hugeness of it attracts our attention, same way with Asbury. So, sure. So I do think if you stay focused on it, I do think it would make a great impact in our local churches.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. When I was in seminary at Southwestern, I was there in the mid-90s, and one of the missions professors, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Jack Gray, had been in the chapel service at Southwestern in the 70s when revival broke out in the chapel service there.
Yeah.
And every Tuesday morning at 6:30, from that point forward, now 20 years later, when I got there, or 25 years later, at 6:30 every Tuesday morning, he would, and anybody wanted to join him, was praying that God would bring revival back to Southwestern. And so even, you know, kind of from my perspective, I keep waiting to see, you know, if the Lord might not show his favor, in another one of the chapel services at Southwestern, just from that commitment to pray and to seek it. Well, appreciate you just kind of discussing some of those things with us. So I know today we want to talk a little bit about what you have as far as a blueprint for the churches to reach their community. And so certainly want to give you some time to share with that. Why don't you take just a few minutes and kind of share what you have for us?
I'll be brief on it. But I operate from what I call a blueprint for evangelism, and it's local church. Most of what I do is local church evangelism. So if I'm helping a pastor, if a pastor says we're not really reaching lost people, we're not growing like we need to be growing, we don't witness like we should, and so on, what I tell them is I have a blueprint, and I let them know when we talk about the blueprint, don't get intimidated. There's a lot to it. Secondly, you never arrive. There is no church that says we're perfect in evangelism. We never arrive. Third, you don't drift toward evangelism. You drift away from it. So even when you think we're doing pretty good at whatever aspect of evangelism we're trying to do, if you take your eyes off of it, and same thing is true of me, if I take my eyes off of being evangelistic, then what happens is I will do a lot of good things, but I won't do evangelism. It's just there's something about evangelism that is easy to not be doing it and doing a lot of good things. And so what I tell pastors is, because normally across the state, if a pastor or a group of pastors talk to me about evangelism, they almost always is talking about personal evangelism, which is part of the blueprint. But to grow a local church and be evangelistic, it's more than just personal evangelism. There's other things involved. So I always start with leadership. And I tell pastors, I certainly read, books on leadership and love to read all kind of guys on leadership. But when it comes to evangelism, Jesus is the model. Look at how Jesus led, from the way he called his disciples to how he modeled it, to how he would not stop talking about evangelism. He just over and over used different illustrations about evangelism. And then after his resurrection, the last thing he says before his ascension is, tarry, receive the power, and you'll be my witnesses. It's almost like he's saying, in case you haven't got this yet, this is why you're here. You need to be about witnessing. And so as a leader, we have to constantly talk about evangelism. And then the components of the blueprint, I'll just tell you the principle, but components of the blueprint is you need to be very intentional about this, be very specific, and this is not in order of importance. When I list the blueprint, I just say, go home, pray about it, get your staff, you have a staff, get your lay leaders, pray about it. What is the one thing you can do on the blueprint that is most needed in your church? And once you feel like you've got this kind of going like it should, don't take your eye off of it. Keep doing it. Maybe get another aspect of the blueprint. So I start with this. Lead your church to pray for lost people by name. Churches that have times of prayer, if they're not intentional, you never hear this. Any prayer request, pray for Bob, my next one, he's lost. Pray for Joe, he's a new coworker. You just don't hear it.
That's right.
The reason is there's not an intentionality to build that culture. So you want to build that culture where this is something that we do, this is who we are, and there are steps you can do to help create that. You can, for example, you can lead small group leaders to ask people when they take prayer requests, once all the prayer requests are given, to say, well, before we pray, does anybody here have a lost person on your mind that maybe you feel freedom to either give us their initials or their first name? And we'd love to pray for them. And just begin to create that culture of evangelism. And I will say this, in churches that do it, it's a blessing to go into a small group or even go into a team, quote, committee meeting. And when they take prayer requests, you hear the normal prayer requests, which we should pray for. Miss Sue's having a knee surgery and so on. So-and-so needs a job. But to hear someone say, pray for Sue, she's lost. It's like, okay, this is what we should be praying for. Second thing I say is the Sunday morning experience. There's certain things that evangelistic churches do on Sunday morning, and I mean from start to finish, from the time people pull up the parking lot till the time they leave, they think through everything. I tell pastors, you don't have to do what other churches are doing. Right. The issue is think through what you're doing. Right.
What works and, in that setting.
Yeah, just think through it. From the time people pulled up, and it's not just for your guests. If you want to grow, it's for everybody. You want the member who's been there for 50 years to have a great Sunday morning experience. So from the time they pull up to the time they leave, which obviously has to do with the greeters, has to do with small groups, has to do with everything. And then even think through, and a lot of pastors don't do this, how are you going to give your invitation? What is the last thing you say? Is there a clarity about what you want people to do, the next steps, and so on? Third part of the blueprint is personal evangelism, which is what everybody wants to talk about. And if you do the personal evangelism, you can weave it through the other components. I will say this. We've been a couple years since we've done this, but when you look at all size churches in Georgia and you take the different sizes, and you look at the top half percent in baptisms, you'll find about almost 90% of churches of any size that lead their category in baptisms, they have at least one intentional time of church training for evangelism every year. Some do more than that. So right away, if I'm a pastor, I'm like, well, if almost 90% do this of any size, if I'm not doing any training, maybe this is something I ought to do. So you do put an emphasis on personal evangelism. Event evangelism is huge. And all churches have events, whether it's right. Vacation Bible School, a women's ministry, a fall festival, a, quote, revival meeting, a men's sports banquet, and so on. They have something. A lot of churches have events, but they don't see people saved. The first time I left the state convention, I went to a church that did a great job with events, but nobody's getting saved. So I sat in on some of the events that were already scheduled, and the first thing I was able to sit in on was a women's tea time in December, and there's like 1,000 women there, and it was well done. It was quality. The only problem is they never present the gospel, which obviously, if you don't present the gospel, the lost person who's there, right. There's no other way to be saved. And so we just was able to tweak that. We were just, after a week or so, I met with the leadership there and said, man, next year do everything the same way. This was awesome. This was a home run. It was quality. Just add 2 minutes. And they're like, what should we add? I said, just the last 2 minutes, present the gospel. So the next year we begin to have people saved. And so when you do your events, make sure that lost people are there. If it's an evangelistic event, lost people's there. Make sure the gospel is clearly presented. And third, make sure there's a clarity about what you want them to do. How do they respond to this invitation? Then also in the blueprint, we talk about what we call team evangelism, which is small groups. Small groups, and you know this, but small groups like Sunday school, the original intent was to reach lost people. And today, that's why lost person come to church. Any church I know of could come to church at Sunday and say, I'd love to join, quote, Sunday school or whatever they call it.
Yeah, that open
today.
Group concept.
And
sure.
It's like, come on, join. And the reason we let people do that is because we know if an unchurched person gets involved in a small group, there's a high percent they'll get saved sooner or later. But begin to use the small group to reach people. And something we did, because I knew that concept, we walked through our building and we counted the number of empty rooms we had. And we said, our goal is to start new small groups. And what that does for you is if you say we're weak in young couples 25 to 35, start a small group, intentionally go after them. And we did that, and it made a huge difference in how the church grew and made a huge difference in the number of unchurched people we were able to reach. And the last thing is ministry service evangelism. We always should have been doing this. I mean, you know, Jesus fed people. He healed people. And obviously, that's a great thing, but he also did because it was a platform to talk about the kingdom and who he is. And so in our day, things have changed. You can't just put up a sign and say, here's an event, and everybody shows up like maybe they did 50 years ago. So every church of any size ought to look for something. It can be small. Maybe there's a police station. Maybe there's a local school. The church I pastored right across the street, right across the road from us, was a school. And so we began to take Chick-fil-A biscuits. We did everything we could. And ultimately, we built a bridge over there where they would call us. In fact, they got where they'd call us if there was a suicide of a parent. They'd call us if a house burnt down. They would just say, hey, this happened. We just found out about it. We knew you'd want to know. The only reason they knew we'd want to know is because of the impact of the Chick-fil-A biscuits, that we kept going over there. And from that, doors opened up to do ministry and stuff. And I would end by saying this. Whatever you decide to do with the blueprint, you can't just talk about it for a week or two. And I always end by saying, use your stage. And I'm talking about the physical stage. Whatever your strategy is, make sure that every Sunday something, I'm not saying a whole message, it could be 30 seconds, but something is said about who you are and what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
I say use your staff. And I know I always say as pastors may say, well, I don't have a staff. I'm like, no, you got a staff. It may be chairman of deacons. They may be unpaid, but even the smallest church has two or three lay people who you'd say these are the best folks we've got, and they'll do anything for us. They'll serve the kingdom. So make sure they know what you're trying to do. I say it because sometimes I'll meet with the associate pastor or youth pastor, and the pastor has told me in two or three meetings just in private, here's what we're trying to do. And I'll ask the youth pastor, well, what are you trying to do with this? I'm not sure. And so right away I know, well, either you haven't been listening or maybe the pastor's been telling me, but he hasn't told the staff yet.
Yeah.
And then I say use a structure, and the structure is just everything that makes your church, women's ministry, men's ministry, children's ministry, small groups, weave your strategy and what you are about through everything in that church so that everybody knows. If they're asked the question, what are we about? The answer is obvious to anybody who attends regularly. Well, this is what we're about. Well, how do you know that? Because the pastor and the staff, this is what they talk about all the time.
Yeah.
And I've been on church staff a long time ago where I don't think our people really knew because we didn't talk about it as much as we should. So whatever you do, just weave it through the whole church. So
That's great. So let me take a couple of takeaways from that. Right. And just as we come to a time of conclusion, the first thing you said I think was excellent, which is makes just a great sound bite, but it's also just something for folks to focus on, is that churches drift away from evangelism versus drifting toward evangelism. Yes. It's just a constant, almost a constant effort that takes for a church to be an evangelistic church.
Yeah.
And then it sounds like just one of the other things that came out to me, Steve, is that really the key differentiator between an evangelistic church and one that's not really that evangelistic is really just intentionality.
It is.
And if they can be intentional in the different things that you mentioned,
yes,
really that's what that's it's not absolutely not great at this or great at that. It's just simply consistent intentionality makes a difference.
Yeah.
So you talk about the blueprint, I guess, for the churches and the folks that are listening. Yeah. Something they can just reach out to you, reach out to the mission board.
Is that
the best way for them to get in contact or to find out more about the blueprint?
Yeah, just reach out to the mission board and look at evangelism and just email us, call us. We'd be glad to sit down with the pastor or staff and walk through it. And any way we can help, we'd be glad to help. So
that's great. I've got one more question before we leave. So you've got the person that's listening, and they're just the typical person that's scared to share their faith. Mm-hmm. What would you say in just a second or two? What words of wisdom or advice would you give for that person that's sitting there that's just really apprehensive? They know they ought to share their faith, but they're apprehensive about sharing their faith. What words would you have to share with them?
I would say, if it's a layperson, I would say to the layperson, go to your pastor or go to someone on the staff of your church, if you have a staff, and tell them, I have a heart to share the gospel and get some training. The training is not going to be hard to get. I mean, they can bring us in. The training's not hard. The key is, though, if you're a Christian and you would say this with humility, you'd say, you know, I'm pretty consistent with church attendance. I'm pretty consistent. I'm a tither. I'm pretty consistent with reading my Bible. I pray. But when it comes to sharing my faith, that's something I don't hardly ever do. The thing that's probably missing is accountability. So what I would do is I'd find me somebody, and quite frankly, I've got somebody. Once a month, I have a conversation with somebody. There's a few questions we talk about, but one question is always, hey, Steve, share your most recent gospel conversation. I know I should be witnessing, but knowing I'm going to have that question asked me, because I'm not going to lie, but I'm not going to make up a story.
Right.
So it's always on my mind, hey, this question is going to be asked of me. And I think the accountability, so I would probably find somebody and just share my heart and say, hey, as a Christian, I feel like most of the disciplines, I'm not perfect, but I feel like I'm moving forward in those disciplines.
Right, sure.
But sharing the gospel, sharing my faith, I'm very weak at it. Would you do me a favor? And either at least once a month, it could be once a week, but at least once a month, have a conversation with them and ask them to ask you the question, share your most recent gospel conversation. And I would probably just say this, hey, if you agree to do this, there's probably going to be some months I'm going to say, I didn't do it this month, but I'm going to try next month. And I'm not going to feel bad that I didn't do it. I'm going to feel good that I'm trying to be the best I can be. And I think the accountability is probably the missing link in a lot of people's gospel conversations. So.
You know, when you think about it, I think the statistic shows that, you know, 70-75% of Georgia unchurched are lost.
Yeah,
just a decent number of our church people sitting in our pews would be willing to step up and say, okay, I'm going to go to my pastor, ask him to help me be accountable to share my faith. Just the number of times the gospel would be presented, and who knows how the Lord might use that to see men and women, boys and girls come to faith in Christ.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, it's been great to have you on, and
good
I appreciate you sharing so much.
Awesome.
Great resources, and I know the folks that are listening that they can reach out to you.
Good to be here.
And I know just your passion, your heart, your years of experience, you'd love to help them. So if you're listening today and you need some assistance with evangelism, Steve's the guy
to
reach out to you and to help you. I would like to, just as we close, say a quick word from a foundation perspective. The Georgia Baptist Foundation, as you know, we really exist to support ministry, and so we're not as much on the front lines, even though we still have the responsibility to share our faith, of course. But we're not so much on the front lines. But one neat thing that's kind of something you might want to consider is that we help folks create estate plans. Maybe if you don't have an estate plan, need to create it or need to update it. But one thing you may not have thought of is that you can actually put your testimony in your estate planning documents.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered, you may not know this, but for an estate plan, it's probated. When the will's probated, it goes on file at the courthouse. And so for generations to come, those who are doing genealogical work see your witness and your testimony even in your estate planning documents if you were to do that. And so I think, you know, maybe years down the road, a great-grandson or great-great-great-granddaughter of mine may be on the verge of trying to decide whether or not they want to make a full commitment to Christ or not, be into genealogy, and actually see in my last will and testament that I've made a profession of faith and sought to serve the Lord. So just kind of a neat thing that if you've never thought of, that we can certainly help you with, and one of the things that we do here at the Georgia Baptist Foundation. Well, Steve, great to have you.
It's good to be here.
Those of you listening, we appreciate you giving us a little bit of your time today, and we hope this information was encouraging and valuable to you. Hope you have a good day. God bless.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to rate and subscribe to our podcast content so you don't miss an episode. At the Georgia Baptist Foundation, we exist to help churches and their members faithfully steward all that God has blessed them with while effectively leveraging their resources for kingdom purposes. We do this in two primary ways. First, we help individuals include gifts in their estate plans and provide assistance with establishing charitable annuities and trusts. Second, we offer long-term, morally screened investments that allow churches and ministries to better steward ministry dollars. If you want to learn more about how we can help you or your church do more with the resources God has blessed you with, contact us at our website at www.gbfoundation.org. Connect with us on social media as well to stay up to date with our latest podcast content, as well as news on educational events and opportunities.